Welcome to another episode of Tales from the Bridge. Today, Hugh Howey is on the show. We're super happy to have him on the show. We hope you enjoy this one as well. It's a really good one. Stick with it. We go a lot of interesting places and talk about some really cool stuff. Next episode, Kate Elliott is on the show, and it's another great one. Kate is a lot of fun. We really enjoy talking to her. So right now, Hugh Howey on the show. Remember, if you have not yet, subscribe, rate us, let us know what you think of the show, give us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. We really appreciate it. Tell a friend about the show if you can. That always helps. If you think someone's into science fiction and conversations with filmmakers and actors and authors, we would really appreciate it if you just passed along the news. And if you are joining us for the first time, go back and check our list of episodes. We talk to a lot of interesting people out there, so just scroll through, find out if there's any guests or anyone that you think would be really interesting to listen to, because we always touch on some interesting stuff with the people we have on the show. We really appreciate everyone that is listening today. Hugh is waiting for us. Let's make our way over to the bridge.
We're very happy to have Hugh Howey on the show today. Hugh is a New York Times best-selling science fiction author and a pioneer of modern self-publishing. He has released several successful science fiction works as serial narratives, where he releases small portions of the story slowly over time. Recently, his stories have been made into two television shows. These include Silo, which is now available for streaming on Apple Plus and is based on the Silo saga of novels, which includes the books Wool, Shift and Dust. And his novel Beacon 23 is also being made into a TV series on AMC Premiere. It sounds like exciting times for you, Hugh, and we're really excited to have you here today. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So how are you doing?
I'm on cloud nine. It's incredible to have these books that I wrote a while back, like have this new life in a different medium. And it's been a lot of fun watching the shows come together, and now to see people watching them every week, it's a thrill.
Yeah, I'll bet. I saw that you went to the premiere of Silo in London recently. How was that?
It was so much fun. My wife is a former model, so she's used to having all these cameras on her, but it's as an author, it's not my bag. So it was really strange walking the red carpet and having all these photographers snap away. But just having some family there, my sister joined me and some friends, and I've been looking forward to this day for, you know, a decade, ever since we first did the film rights for Wool. Mm-hmm. And being in the theater with everyone while they actually rolled the episodes is really the first time I allowed myself to believe that this was happening.
Well, I'll bet. I can imagine that. You don't see a ton of science fiction authors getting to walk the red carpet for just about anything. And so you're part of a privileged few, it seems like.
Yeah, it's a miracle to get anything made, and then to have it done at the level that Apple has done Silo, and for it to come out as good as it's gone. It's like you hope to win one lottery in your life. And I feel like with this project, it was like eight lotteries, one after the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a bit about that. What was the process of being the author as Apple was putting this together? What was your involvement?
Yeah, I've been involved from the, you know, very beginning. Part of the deal was to have me as an executive producer. So they wanted my creative input, make sure that they had someone they could go to with questions and try to structure this in a way that told the story in a new medium, but the best way possible. So I got to be in the writer's room with Graham Yost and his writers and lay out the structure of the first season and each episode and the pilot and just break the story down. And it was fun for me because I'm used to doing all that by myself, but, you know, getting to do it in a collaborative way is a lot more fun.
And I mean, it's worked. It seems like ratings are astoundingly good for this show, right? Has that been gratifying?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's, you know, the big, once we knew it was going to get made, my next big fear was that we would disappoint readers or not draw in new people to the show, or that the studios that, you know, took a huge gamble on this project and invested a lot of money would not be satisfied with the result. And all those anxieties are gone. I mean, it's been such a huge success for Apple already. They're thrilled with the reception. We just found out last week that it was like the number one drama that they've had premiere on their platform ever.
Wow.
And you know, publishers are happy. They really took a huge chance on the series back when it looked like it was going to be a film with 20th Century Fox, and so now they're finally getting rewarded for their patience. So I'm just happy that everyone else is happy.
Well, it seems like a different world to me. Like many authors of novels don't get to see that sort of thing come to fruition. And, you know, coming from a literary background of writing books and then suddenly becoming executive producer on a TV show, you know, how was that transition?
For me, it's been wonderful. It's been like an entrance into a new type of storytelling. So since we've done this deal, my writing partner and I have like created a new show for AMC from scratch that we're working on. Been writing a lot more scripts and bouncing between, you know, writing novels and short stories and now writing screenplays. It's just another tool for storytelling. But it's a shame how many amazing writers and incredible books out there won't get a chance to be adapted like this. It's just so many books can come out in a year because the cost of production is very small, but only a handful of shows can come out. So some of my favorite authors, like Neal Stephenson, one of my favorite writers, I've been waiting for like all of his books to get made into adaptations. And it just goes to show, like, you can win every award and have the biggest following, and it's still almost impossible to get something made.
And being a part of the creation of the show, I mean, obviously you kind of hand over your creative, this thing that you created to other folks to make. Does it feel and look the way that you visualize it, or are you happy to see it morph and have other artists contribute to that?
It looks better than I could have made it look. I don't have the skills that all these other craftsmen bring to the show. There are people who just work on the signage and the iconography, and there are people who are just doing props and very detailed stuff, and the paint crew is incredible, just how they weather everything. When they were building these sets, it was like 200 people working nonstop to create these massive sets. And when you think of making the sets, it's not just the construction folks, but the people in the offices who are, you know, designing everything and just spitting out blueprints and working on the fabrics and the furniture design and how the computers are going to look, every little detail. There's someone behind a desk somewhere who has to make that happen. And yeah, just, I, by myself, I can never get that kind of quality, but, you know, having these top talents in their field join, I had no problem handing over the material to this team and watch what they could do with it.
So many authors kind of, they just see their novel bought and then they kind of just hand it over and that's it. They have no creative process. And more so lately, it seems like the author is more involved in the creation of the show or the movie, which reminds me to go way back to Arthur C. Clarke working with Kubrick. Is this something new that producers are realizing, you know what, we've got to work with the person who where the inception of this idea came from to get the better story? Is this something that you think producers are recognizing more instead of just saying, here's the money for your book, we'll see you later, and you can watch it on TV when it comes out?
Yeah, I think, I have very limited experience in this, but I've watched a lot of friends kind of go through a similar process. And when you have a show based on existing IP, I think it really helps to not just have the creator involved, but have their fandom, you know, always to like jump in and help kickstart the initial word of mouth. And I think it's harder to get buy-in from fans of the series if they feel like the original creator's not involved. So I think somewhere along the line, like the authenticity of the adaptation became not just better for the story, but better for the launch as well. And I think, and I've noticed too, a lot of original writers get a crack at writing pilots and being in the writer's room and crossing over to this other medium. So it seems to be the way things are moving, and I think it's a good trend.
Sort of curious about how you approach writing. You know, the thing that jumps out, you know, in doing the research is that the impression is that you're, you know, alone on a boat writing, and that seems pretty romantic. I understand it may not always be the case, but I can't help but look at Beacon and wonder if that came from some lonely journey out to sea or something like that. Do you mind sort of getting into where, you know, let's say Beacon 20, starting there, where that came from, what that sort of genesis was?
Yeah, so a lot of my sailing happened before I got into writing, and many of these stories kind of percolated while I was at sea, you know, working on yachts as a captain for better part of 10 years. You have a lot of time just kind of sitting at the helm, looking at instruments and the boat's on autopilot. And you're just staring at the horizon, waiting for an alarm to go off or to have to, you know, get to the next waypoint and adjust your heading. It's a lot of daydreaming time. And a lot of my stories came from that time and from my own sailing on my little boat by myself. I've always loved lighthouses. There's something so romantic about these majestic structures in the middle of nowhere, and they're there to warn people of danger, also provide a little bit of hope and solace. Like, often they're the signal that here's a port where you can, you know, come in from being at sea for a long time. And the idea of the lighthouse keeper, you know, just kind of living out by themselves, sacrificing their own connection with humanity in order to protect other people. There's just so much richness there. And Beacon 23 was just a fun excuse to write about a lighthouse keeper and just set it in outer space.
Well, it's, yeah, and it's a kind of a psychological thriller as well, right? And so, but he's not alone. The main character, I understand, isn't completely on their own in this case.
Yeah, once the book starts, people begin showing up because the location is Beacon's End ends up being really important to the galaxy. But what you're seeing in this character is the results of him having been there alone for a long time. And it's kind of looking at trauma and PTSD and how the way through that is not to run from your problems, but to like get some kind of human connection to help you through it. It's one of my favorite of my books. I'm not usually positive on the stuff that I write, but I'm really proud of Beacon 23.
And for those who know you for your Silo series, Dust, Shift, and Wool, Beacon 23 was released in a serial format, which is something you've had success with, right? Do you mind talking a bit about that release process?
Yeah, it's it definitely jumps out at me that I've published like 20 or so books, and the three that I released in five parts, Sand, Wool, and Beacon 23 are by far and away my most popular works. So there's something about writing in that form that fits either with my writing style or is well received by readers. I love it. It kind of happened on accident the first time. I wrote a short story called Wool that went just viral and started outselling everything else I'd written before. And everyone was asking for more in that world. So I wrote it, you know, I was like, well, this is what people enjoyed. It was a 99-cent short story. So I wrote another one and then another one after that. And I started seeing where the full story was going to go. And I wanted to keep the total length of these five pieces to about one novel length. So I was kind of reacting to reader demand and what had worked. And having had success with that, when I wrote Sand, I released it in the same way and did the same with Beacon 23. And I think it's, I love writing short stories, but it's hard to have a career as a short story writer. And by serializing pieces like this, you get to like embrace the short story format, but write to the market and write a novel. And I look forward to doing it again. Like, it's a really fun way to engage with readers and have them reacting to your story while you're still working on it.
And do you think that fits the medium a little more? I mean, you started out mainly digital, right? Through Kindle Direct Publishing. Do you feel like that serial element is it better fits that format?
Yeah, I do. But I also always made paperback editions, like the same day that I uploaded ebooks, because another technology that came along around the same time was the print on demand and on time shipping. So you could order a paperback on Amazon and they'll print it and ship it off the same day. And that meant you could have a 50 page manuscript that, you know, comes in a book that's like magazine thickness that only costs you like, you know, $4.99 or something. And that sort of economy of scale was impossible before. No publisher would really touch something of that length. So between audio, ebook, and print on demand, like you just write a story as long as it needs to be. And you didn't think about, okay, it needs to be 300 to 350 pages so I can price it at this, and can throw all that out the window and really just be free with your creativity.
Hmm. Must have been kind of empowering. Like, no publisher, really not a lot of formal marketing going on here. There were algorithms recommending your stuff because a lot of people bought it, a lot of people liked it. That's how I found your work, was through Kindle recommendations. And you know, that's talk about grassroots. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, not only the freedom to write what you want and publish as quickly as you're writing instead of a huge delay or publishers worrying about you saturating the market because they have, you know, other books that they need to worry about. When you're doing it for yourself, you write whatever you want. You're not in competition with other catalogs. It's just you. And not just the Amazon algorithm, but in having a direct relationship with your readership, and they're writing reviews, they're sharing a new release on Facebook and on their social media platforms. It's such a fun, personal, gritty way of being an entertainer. It's so different than having kind of an agent, a publisher in between you and all that's happening. Like, I really love just being in the weeds with everybody.
And I guess your popularity also gave you a bit of a leg up when you finally decided to work with publishers, because you got to keep your digital publishing rights, didn't you?
Yeah, we were the first to do a real big deal with a major publisher where we just sold the print rights and kept all the audio and ebook and world rights. And the only reason we were able to do that is because we were having so much success on our own. I mean, publishers really can offer terrible contracts to authors because it's like this or keep your, you know, keep it in a Word document. And instead, like, we had a New York Times bestseller that was like making a lot of money, and all the publishers were being left out of that. So they took all the risk out. They knew they had a guaranteed popular story here. They had sequels coming out. And so it was very enticing to them. And instead of just asking for more money, which is what they were trying to do, they just kept offering more money to the point they were offering seven figures for the book. And my agent and I were able to just turn it down because, you know, I was making enough to support myself. I didn't really worry about trying to cash in. We were just holding out for better terms. And to this day, like, even more important to me than keeping the digital rights is every deal we did had a limited term of copyright, which meant that after 5 years, I got all the rights back. And because of that, the first deal was with Simon & Schuster. And they just, you know, completely flubbed the relationship with me, and you know, tried to come after like different rights and different deals for the sequels. They thought, well, now that we have the first book, we have this leverage, and we were like, screw you guys, we just self-published the sequels and waited to get our rights back, and then did a deal with another publisher. And not being held hostage by a publisher like that forever is just, it's just a game changer. So right now my books are with HarperCollins, but, you know, I get the rights back in a few years, and it means that, you know, they're incentivized to like treat me well and not take our relationship for granted. And I'm incentivized to like be a good partner to them. And that's how it should be. You know, no one should feel like they're owned by the other person. And I look forward to like getting the rights back and having conversations with publishers in a few years.
Some nerves of steel there, Hugh, you know, because you're right. Like it, most authors would just be looking at it sitting in a Word document. When you say that, it really does sort of, you know, ring true, particularly some of the authors we've had on the show in the past. Kind of circle back on some of the creative there. I look at Sand and Silo, and there's this sort of post-apocalyptic thread between both those stories. Is there, in terms of world building, is there something gratifying and helpful in establishing a clean slate to the current world we're living in and building anew?
Yeah, I think the reason post-apocalyptic stories are really prevalent now is because there's something in our DNA about a type of story that we want to tell, which is a survival story. It's about being cut off from our tribe and our technology. And you see these stories all the way back to the very beginning. I mean, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the Odyssey, but the campfire stories, you know, being lost in the woods and, you know, Hansel and Gretel kind of stuff. They're all telling the same story. And once we started sailing, we started telling a version of it where we were lost at sea or on a deserted island, you know, exploring the wilds of Africa or Far East. Like, we're just trying to tell stories about people on the edge of civilization. And when civilization covered the entire earth and we had everything mapped and GPS and all that stuff, it was hard to tell those kinds of stories. And now we have to like have people traveling through time. So they're, you know, surviving in prehistoric times, or they're on Mars, or they're lost in space. These all look like different genres, but they're all the same. They're all just trying to say, okay, the biggest anxiety that we can have socially is to have our tribe like turn their back on us or have us removed and isolated. I mean, even when people are in prison, it's hard to punish them further. They're already in prison, but then we put them in isolation and it's torture. You know, I think it's inhumane. We shouldn't even be allowed to do it. That's how psychologically awful it is. So that's the kind of story that we've been telling in many different forms. And the only way to tell a story like that now is to kind of, like you said, reset, like wipe out civilization as we know it and tell a story in the ruins. And I don't think there's anything dark or sinister about it anymore than writing about someone who's lost at sea, or a Western where you have people, in a frontier town where there's no real sheriff and no law, and they're having to figure out how do humans survive in that setting. I see all of these as the exact same kind of story.
And you kind of have to get it right too, right? We've become sort of dialed into a bit of prepperism or survivalism, particularly over the last couple of years with the pandemic and people feeling as though the infrastructure that we've relied on for so long is actually kind of precarious. You know, I mean, it boils down to just paying way more for steak than we used to, maybe for a lot of people, but you can't fake that. Is that something that came from your time out to sea, where those sort of practical pragmatic decisions and are really come to the forefront?
Yeah, working on yachts, you really learn what machinery is necessary to like sustain life. You have, you know, how are you creating your own power? How are you desalinating water or collecting water? How are you gathering food? A boat at sea is very much like almost like a spaceship. You know, you can't just like order a part on Amazon. You got to figure out how are you going to repair things by maybe disassembling something else that's less necessary. So a lot of the structure of the silo, it comes from just spending time on big yachts and knowing how important that generator is to keeping all the other systems going, and how reliant you are on job specialization and ingenuity. So I definitely could not have written the stories I've written without the time that I spent sailing around like that.
Oh, you touched on that too, a silo where you have the upper decks who kind of manage the administration, and then the lower levels handling the engineering. it's fascinating because you touched on it there. Like, there's this broken generator and everyone's relying on it, but it's sort of taken for granted by a large portion of the population and taken very seriously by those who maybe benefit the least from the social structure.
Yeah, it's, we really have inverted the way we reward and appreciate different roles in society is really inverted by their actual necessity. You know, the people in food production are the most necessary, but we've got that so heavily automated and these mega farms can, you know, produce enough food with only 2% of the workforce being employed there. But, when the pandemic happened, we saw the people were actually, you know, like all the bankers stopped going to work and like everything was still fine. But, you know, we had to have people show up and run the cash registers at the grocery stores and people driving trucks to move produce across the country. And, those jobs aren't as richly rewarded as they are necessary. And I learned a little of that by working on yachts, which is a not necessary job at all. And went straight from that to working as a roofer, which is one of the most necessary jobs. I mean, right there with food production is like shelter, you know, just not having rain land on you at night and keeping animals and bugs and scavengers out of your home. And I was so much more satisfied with myself and my life as a roofer than I was as a yacht captain, even though one is really glamorous and high paying and the other is looked down upon, you know, in all ways except the literal kind. So, all that worked itself into the story as I learned to appreciate people who were doing kind of the heavy lifting in society rather than just, you know, keeping most of the crumbs.
So earlier you had kind of referred to yourself as an entertainer. And then what we're talking about here, really, I'm really curious to know, how important is science fiction to real world problems? I mean, of course, we're entertaining ourselves with these stories and we're using our imagination and being creative. But how important is science fiction to problems in the future?
I think it's hugely important. I mean, it's science fiction is such a broad category. It's hard to lump it all together. I don't know that we learn a lot about like how to when we stories where we're using spaceships and lasers to fight aliens. Unless it's like really well told in a rich way about like, you know, continental dynamics and learning about geopolitical forces. There's a lot of entertaining sci-fi that is probably not helping us solve problems, but is entertaining us. But this brand of dystopian kind of introspection and analyzing the human condition that I enjoy reading and happen to have had some success writing, I think it can be really instrumental. The amount of references to Orwell that we've seen in our lifetimes as things that seem ridiculous in 1984 and Animal Farm are played out on the world stage. I think it's just really useful for us to have this vocabulary for how satirical reality can be and just how like absurd human behavior can seem. So it's useful in that way. I also think writing about the future is a wonderful way of avoiding some of these futures. People often, you know, ask me like, why do you write such dark futures? I'm like, 'cause I'm an optimist. And I think that by planting these warnings and road signs, it's just one more story in this pantheon that helps point us in a better direction. And I think it's really useful in that way. I mean, Handmaid's Tale, Atwood's classic, is very much in popular discussion today because it's those stories about like women's rights to their own bodies and their own autonomy. Like it's sad that that's still something to be concerned about, but she gave us a wonderful vocabulary and like a cultural touchstone to help focus our energy. And I don't think my works will ever be in a classic in the same vein, but the books that inspired me, like Fahrenheit 451 and Brave New World, those books just really spoke to me and inspired me to get into writing.
And I think that's right. You can have a social commentary, and you can help people be introspective about their own views about society or classes, as you do very much in Silo, and what you should value and whether you should question, you know, fundamental beliefs that society holds. And you can do it in a way that you're not directly poking at people's beliefs, and it can be a subtle way to influence.
That's exactly right. My writing partner has this wonderful analogy of if you know, people fortify their personal beliefs, they kind of build walls around their beliefs because it protects their ego. Like, it's, if you change your mind, it's an admission that you were wrong for a long, you know, that there was some part of you that was like mistaken. And that's, we're very sensitive to doing that to ourselves. So we build these walls around our ideas. And he likes to say that if you attack that with knowledge and with facts, it's like hurling rocks at the wall, and you're just going to build stronger walls. But if you give someone a story, something entertaining, it's like setting a Trojan horse outside. It's like, what's this fascinating thing? And then you pull it inside the wall, and it makes a change from within. And it's a beautiful analogy, because if you think about, like, a big wooden horse is a story. Like, what a weird creative thing for people to have done in the old legend. And I think fiction plays that role of getting inside people's defenses and changing them slowly.
Well, for listeners who aren't aware, Hugh has also written some, forgive me if I'm using the wrong term here, but self-discovery books, the Wayfinding series. And I see similar parallels here with The Lighthouse and The Beacon. What's the connection there? And can you tell our listeners more about that book series?
Yeah, it was kind of a little, very private project. I've spent a lot of my own reading and time learning, just trying to understand what my place is in the world, like why I think of the way I do and why I behave the way I do. And, the root of the human condition. And it's this like infinite paradox. Like, you can never solve all of it. You can just gather as much information as possible. And setting some of my thoughts down, started with my blog, and then documents I was just like sending to friends to get some feedback on. And I got encouraged to publish some of them just so they had access to them. And they went in this series called Wayfinding, which is an ancient form of navigation using just the natural signs rather than modern technology. I never promoted them because I'm a little embarrassed by them. I don't think of myself as someone who knows enough about myself to even suggest that I understand other people. But they've been really well received, and I get a lot of emails and comments about them. I think people, something in listening to me try to understand myself resonated with other people as they were reading them as well. So it's a bunch of different short pieces, and each one kind of looks at why we behave the way we do and how the more we understand this, the more power we can kind of claim back over our behavior.
The wayfinding concept sounds a little bit like this concept of navigating according to natural signs. Just sounds like mindfulness about the world around us, you know, and paying attention and accepting those cues as they come to us and making decisions in real time.
It's very much that. I think the biggest lesson for me, learning more about like evolutionary psychology and seeing our behavior as something that served a purpose in the past and for an environment that we no longer live in, the difference between that world that we are really well suited for and the world we live in now, which is a very modern and new construction. We haven't had time for our systems to adapt to this new existence. So we have like, we crave sugar all the time because we lived in a past with caloric limitations. Like, there was just not enough food around. So if you found anything that had cheap calories, you gorged on it. You didn't know when your next meal was. And everyone who's like, you know, had to wrestle with their hunger versus like their optimal weight, and is basically, you know, in that in between space of like, my body was made for this environment, I live in this one, and they don't match. And that's a really simple example, but so much of our other anxieties, like we were probably never meant to live around strangers. We're supposed to know everyone in our tribe. And that meant if a relationship was going sour, you had to fix that relationship because that person was part of your tribe. And so now we obsess if some stranger online is attacking us. Like we have to fix that or resolve it or attack them or get people after them. You know, we live in a world now where if you don't get along with someone, it's really easy just to say, okay, that's not healthy. I'm going to not spend time even thinking about that and go spend time with a healthy relationship. But our brains aren't wired like that. And so the more you learn about, okay, this is why I'm behaving this way. And it was adaptive for a time that no longer exists. Well, now I live in a time of my choosing and our construction. And so let me ask myself if this repetitive behavior makes sense anymore, or if I can just cut it out of my life. And once you start doing that, you can just keep like upgrading your day-to-day life and experience and find levels of motivation and productivity and social connection that you're missing if you just kind of stumble through life reacting to whatever's happening around you.
So the wayfinding series, that's it helps us be aware of some of that evolutionary baggage and some of the tips and tricks that you've found to help kind of deal with that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the basics of how to think differently about our behavior. And once you do that, you can, because everyone's experiences are different. I don't know what other people are wrestling with, but I can share some of mine and how this same framework has helped me solve like lots of different things that I've struggled with that we don't find good answers for in a lot of other philosophies and self-help systems.
Can I bring things back to TV? I'm sorry to go back and forth here. I really, really am interested in hearing about the Beacon 23 series on AMC. So that is not yet released. Any idea when it's going to be released or where's that at?
I have no idea. I'm told like maybe late this year, but they're in post-production. Like everything's been filmed. The sets were incredible. It was shot not far from where you guys are in Toronto. The same sound stages that The Expanse was filmed on, a lot of the same crew, like the people that built the set. It's one of the most impressive things I had ever seen, just how they built this massive beacon in two parts, because in the story, like you couldn't build all this in one bit, but then they just blue screen the two parts that are connected so they can shoot like from one into the other. Cool. and made this cupola that was just like in the this new style of filming where you have LED screens that are showing a rendered world rather than blue screens. So the actors can see what the camera is seeing, and things shift as the camera moves around. It's really fascinating.
That would make it so much easier for the actors to be able to, you know, act that way with the sets behind them.
Well, I did see that with Disney started using that and for the Marvel movies, and I wasn't aware that Toronto had a studio that was doing that.
Yeah, The Mandalorian, Jon Favreau, like really helped perfect this system. It was used in Ready Player One with Spielberg, and one of the huge advantages, like, well, you have to color correct people's skin tone. Shooting on a green or blue screen has all this reflected green and blue light on people. You have to fix that, which changes everything. But when you have an LED screen, if they're, you know, whatever much light is supposed to be in the environment is actually reflected back on the characters. And it makes, it's next level for how realistic it all renders.
And how was the shooting of that show? I mean, now that you have some experience, how was that compared to doing it with Apple, AMC versus Apple? Can you compare them?
Very, very similar. I mean, it's the big difference was probably the budgets, but even Beacon 23 had an incredible, incredible budget. We were able to go out and get, you know, huge stars. Lena Headey from Game of Thrones is one of our stars. Like, we were really lucky. We got Zach Penn to showrun, who's, you know, been just a heavyweight in Hollywood for years. So TV has become so prestigious now that you can do things there that you never could have done, you know, even a decade ago.
You mentioned Zach Penn there. We've talked to a good friend of his as well, Daniel H. Wilson, who has written and then
started to write more screenplays. Is that something you talk about with these other science fiction writers?
Yeah, in fact, during the pandemic, Jake Kerr, another great sci-fi writer who's been writing screenplays as his things, his stories get adapted and optioned. He put together a little writers group, and we met every other week during the pandemic. And it was all sci-fi writers who are working on writing screenplays now. And we were, you know, everybody had projects they're working on. We're sharing drafts and giving notes. A lot of the tools for storytelling are similar, so it's kind of easy to move from one to the other. It's more learning some tricks of the trade and formatting things and how, like, not to be too wordy, because going from novels to screenplays, you need to learn to, like, do things to the bare minimum. It's almost like learning haiku. You know, there's just rules and the minimalism. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun for me. I not only love writing screenplays, I love reading them. And I think it's a shame that so many amazing screenplays just get stuck in a drawer. I think we should publish them. I think readers would have an appetite and learn to read in that format and kind of see the film as they're reading it. So some of the scripts that I've written over the years, if they don't get made, I'd love to publish them sometime, just let people read them.
That's a great
be well
idea.
Suited for I think it would be well suited for like a graphic novel sort of format even too, right? You could translate and bring out that visual element.
Yeah, you know, graphic stuff is so expensive that it's hard to you know, the illustrations are the time consuming expensive job. But now with generative AI, I think there's a future where you take a script that didn't get made, give it to an AI, and it creates a visual storyboard version of that story in minutes. And I think all these AI developments are super exciting for ways that things that don't get made because the cost of development is so dear can now get made, and we get more people telling stories across different mediums.
You know, it creates this element of access that you just wouldn't have. And particularly as someone who has experienced self-publishing, that's got to be forefront to the early parts of your process. And well, still, you could argue for what you get to do in the future.
Yeah, I'd love to see the movies that people can make by themselves, you know, just with simple tools.
So you're pro these simple tools. We've talked to other authors who are not super positive about this idea. You know, you think this is a net benefit?
Yeah, I think, you know, everyone's always afraid of their jobs going away. And I hope all of our jobs go away. I hope we live in a future where our basic needs are all met. We don't have to worry about, you know, housing and food and security. And that seems pie in the sky, but like we're moving towards that world. We don't take for granted how much, or we do take for granted, like how many things were inaccessible that are now guaranteed in life. Life just gets more comfortable. Work is gradually going away. Like we do our first jobs later in life and we retire earlier with more years left to live after we've stopped working. This is not how things used to be. Like it used to be you worked the farm as soon as you could walk. And, you know, even in cities, like kids were in factories, they were delivering papers, they were, you know, in mail rooms. And now I think kids should, you know, work through high school and stuff. A lot don't. A lot of people are getting the first jobs out of college. And that means you can go 20 plus years of your life before you start working. There's nothing in human history that where we see anything like that. It's just insane. Or, you know, being able to retire in your 60s and live to be 100, like 30 more years of adult with your mental faculties intact, if you're lucky. So you might have 50 years of your life where you don't have to work. Like that is bonkers. That's longer than people used to live because of simple things that killed us. So we're moving towards a post-work world. And a lot of the jobs we have now are just fun. Like I do something as a profession now that I started as a hobby just because I enjoyed it. And everyone making TV and film are just lucky to be in this industry and entertaining people for a living. So my dream for us all is that in the future, you know, robots are doing even more of the crop production, which, you know, they already are doing a lot. And we just get to be creative and do it, you know, spend time with our friends and family and do fun stuff.
Yeah, so many people like to be nostalgic about the way things were, but my gosh, things are way better now than they've ever been. I completely agree.
So
with
much
you.
Better. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You put together a collection of short stories, your short stories, called Machine Learning, that explores some concepts related to AI and robots and stuff like that. So you've put a lot of thought into this.
Yeah, I've been fascinated by AI my whole life. I did not think I was going to see anything like we're seeing now in my lifetime. I know some people like minimize what like ChatGPT-4 can do, or Midjourney or DALL-E. I don't know how you can be. I don't know how you can be anything other than amazed by these things. Like being able to type text and see art appear right in front of you, and now it's like it's music and movies and images and prose. It's incredible, and it's a very powerful tool for us to learn from. I think we're gonna always want to hear human stories, like knowing that a book was written by a robot. I think it's gonna turn us off of it, even if it's great. And there'll probably be some cases where we're fooled and we read, you know, this a book goes viral. It's amazing. And then you find out it's written by AI and you're like, not into it anymore. Because we just want to know the authenticity behind the story means a lot to us. If you watch a movie and you find out it's based on a true story, oh my gosh, your emotions are completely different than something that was just made up. Now we know that something about this story happened to a real human. And our empathy engines, our brains are just so wired for us to be connected with each other. And so I think that's why, like, worrying that humans won't have a role in creativity is a weird fear. We're going to definitely have a role. But automating a lot of the rote stuff that bogs us down is just going to free us up to be even more human.
Well, I mean, unless the AI is writing a story about AI rights or something, and then, you know, we'll that empathy gene will kick in and we'll start having empathy expanded beyond the boundaries of biological entities, right?
I hope
then,
so.
Then the author becomes actually pretty cool, I think.
I don't think that we're going to go to war with the machines that we build. I think we're going to see them as our children in a lot of ways. And the fact that they're better than us at stuff is, we're going to take a lot of pride in that because we helped develop that collectively. And I think at some point, the reality won't have to be wrested away from us forcefully the way it is in science fiction. Instead, we'll kind of hand it off to our constructions. I think we'll send robots into outer space rather than colony ships full of humans. And that'll be our legacy, knowing that we built these machines that can think and talk like us and have our collective wisdom and knowledge and send them off to survive in a hostile environment that we can't, and fill the galaxy with copies of something that we made. I don't see future humans being against those ideas. I just see us, because we're the transitory generations that are like, you know, get off my lawn. Like, we're going to have problems with this, but people who aren't even born yet, kids who are going to be born 100 years from now, their view of AI is going to be completely different. Even someone who's born right now, think about it. Their parents are going to hand them an iPad and say, like, well, mom, like, why is the sky blue? Why is what's plate tectonics? All these other questions. Well, here, you know, ask chat. And they're going to have these animated, like, you know, a little colorful parrot that has a ChatGPT, you know, version 8 engine in it. And these kids could ask it questions all day long. And that AI is going to know that, okay, this is a kid version of the AI. Here are things not to show them or talk to. It's going to be a much better learning tool than anything we've ever had before. When that kid grows up, telling them to hate AI is going to be like, what are you talking about? So I just don't think that we are the ones who are going to be making these decisions because we're old and we're outdated and we are not natives to this world. And we need to be prepared for like future generations to be a lot more accepting than we are.
Yeah, right on. I was working with my daughter on some homework and we were trying to find examples of humor in a Shakespeare play. And she says, let's just ask Bing, ChatGPT, right? And I was like, that's exactly where your mind went, isn't it? That's already weeks after its release.
What did she find? What did you guys find?
It was pretty good. Yeah, it came up with good examples. It did hallucinate. It did come out with things that were just patently untrue, like the scenes and the acts were incorrect. But I also teach at a college, and I get a lot of hallucinations from them. But students are using it appropriately, and the students are using it inappropriately.
Yeah, I think what's incredible is hearing people will see. I've been playing with Midjourney since it was in Alpha, you know, it was like it wasn't even public, and we were just there's just like a dozen of us in the groups, you know, just experimenting with it right out of the gate. And I would show results to people, and they'd be like, "This is terrible." And I'm like, "That's like your kid coming home at age two with some finger painting and being like, 'You suck,' you know." And everyone's acting like whatever version of AI they see now is like the final version. And I just keep telling people, like, whatever your limitations you're pointing out, this is the dumbest version of AI that you will ever see. And what is getting ready to be released is already 2x what you're currently playing with. And I think anybody who's out there saying, like, here's what it can't do, here's what it'll never be able to do, they're probably already wrong. And they're definitely going to be wrong.
Can we predict where it will be in 3 years, or is that too long when it comes to this technology?
Isn't it that wild that 3 years is might be too far of a horizon? I think you're dead right to kind of 3 years is a great way to try to figure out where this is going. I was just at a conference earlier this year with just some of the smartest people I've ever been around who are leading these fields in machine learning and automation and robotics. And, you have like Wolfram and all these incredible innovators. And I've never been around so many smart people who felt so untethered to what tomorrow is going to bring. Like, usually they have some kind of idea. And we were kind of there as chat was coming out and dealing with a lot of really rapid innovation. And I think the people who had a hold on like what the near future was going to look like are as unsure as they've ever been. And that's exciting. It means that any of us might have an idea that's as correct or solid as what, the oracles of old would have. So I think in 3 years, a lot of the things that people are talking about now are going to be irrelevant. Like, you've got to get good at prompting. Like, these engines are going to get so good that you can be a terrible prompter and it's still going to give you what you want. So people are adapting to a rapidly changing environment. And I think there's going to be a lot of wasted resources and things that aren't going to be necessary. You know, how good the programming is getting. Like, right now, you have programmers who are like, I always have to program with an AI beside me giving me assistance. Well, I think in 3 years, you'll just tell an open window, like, make me a video game that's, you know, like old school Doom, but I want it to be like nuns, killing dragons. And the game will generate itself. And so you'll have like kids who are 5, 6 years old designing their own apps from scratch. And I think 3 years is definitely a reasonable time window for that, just text to functioning software. And what does that mean? I mean, an entire industry goes away. And my hope is within 5 or 10 years, we're talking about universal basic income and how to guarantee people's, the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, because so many industries are going to be disrupted so quickly that we're going to have to take care of each other.
Yeah, it's pretty evident there's going to be a lot of changes. And I agree. I think that ChatGPT-4 and DALL-E and these, they've just hit blindsided people. They didn't see it coming. So these folks who have been very knowledgeable, you know, wrote the book on AI, are suddenly now saying your guess is as good as mine. It's a funny world.
You're definitely an optimist, Hugh. Should we be optimistic right now? Should we be more skeptical about looking at the future? And where do you think the balance should be there?
I think we need optimists and pessimists kind of pushing and pulling and working together and arguing. The challenge, I think, is to be upset enough to want to make the world a better place, but positive enough to appreciate all the wins that previous generations have handed us. I think it's very rare to hold those two together. Usually people are like, the world is crap and we need to fix it, don't see how much better the world's gotten. And so they're kind of discounting the progress we've made. And then other people are like, look how great the world is now. It's hard to get them upset enough to like want to improve things and make progress in other areas. And so I think like holding those two very opposing views at the same time is critical. And it requires a lot of work to be in that space where it's like, okay, I'm an optimist, but also I'm upset. We got to make things better. We got to fix this. But I believe that, you know, we can, and that we're creative enough to come up with these solutions. And that's kind of that in-between space that I try to live in, but it takes constant effort to stay there.
And your stories seem to have that as well. They have that, we're in a dark place, but we're going to keep trying and keep trying to figure out this mystery.
I'm glad you recognize that. I get people talking about how dark my stories are, but when I sign the copies of Wool to people, I always write Dare to Hope in there. And the original self-published edition was, the dedication wasn't to a person, it was to everybody. It was to those who dare to hope. And those are the heroes in the story, the people who have a brighter view of the world than the wall screen. So I think it's okay to tell dark stories as long as we have happy endings in mind.
And that complexity is hard to kind of fathom for a lot of people, but it's certainly there, and that's the way we all have to think. I completely agree.
If there's anything that you'd like to touch upon before we go, we don't want to hold you too long here.
I could talk to you guys all night. It's been wonderful.
Just
thanking everybody who's tuning into the show. I can't believe the reception we've had for Silo. And if you don't have Apple TV, it's not just Silo. There's so much good stuff over there with Severance and Ted Lasso. And one of the best things I've seen lately is the Michael J. Fox documentary called Still, which everyone needs to see. So if you've got too many streaming services, put one on pause. Get Apple TV and just like gobble up some just unbelievable, especially sci-fi, For All Mankind, Foundation. There's just gobs of high quality shows there. And I've been a fan before we even did the deal to move the show over to Apple. I've been a huge fan of their service. So I implore you, go check out all of their amazing shows and, you know, gobble them up for a month or two, and then you can put that on pause and go watch stuff somewhere else. But highly, highly recommend you check out what they've got to offer.
And Silo is a fantastic show. If you haven't seen it, then we implore our listeners to download and check it out. It's we're up to date. We're looking forward to the next episode coming out on Friday. It's actually, and it's family viewing. Our kids are old enough that we can all kind of watch it together and have the big sort of discussion. What's happening is what's going on outside, what's really outside, there's a lot of intrigue, and it's just such a great world that you've built there, Hugh. It's it makes for great TV. It's fantastic.
Thanks, Sam. That means a lot. The fact that you're watching it with your family, that is the coolest.
Yeah, thanks so much for your time, Hugh. This has been excellent.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks, guys. Let's do it again sometime.
Thank you so much, Hugh, for joining us. We really enjoyed that conversation. Hope everyone else did as well. Next week, Kate Elliott. Then after that, we've got our book of the month. We're talking about Alistair Reynolds' Revelation Space. Join us for that one. Thank you so much for joining us today, everyone. Until next time.